Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Joseph Pache. This hour, we'll be talking about sports-related concussions in school-age kids. Each year, over 250,000 children and teens in the U.S. sustain head injuries during organized sports or recreational activities that are serious enough to warrant a visit to the emergency room. While about three-quarters of these traumatic brain injuries are considered to be mild, they're treated as concussions. And what we're learning is that these injuries are often not mild at all. They can actually be quite serious. As Bay Area kids head back to football, soccer, and other fall sports, we'll talk about how to recognize and respond when a young athlete suffers a head injury, and we'll explore measures that are being taken to prevent concussions from occurring on the playing field at all. And joining me tonight by phone and in the studio are three experts in this area. Our first guest joining us by phone is Dr. Cindy Chang. She is sports medicine specialist with the UCSF Benioff Children's Hospitals and Sports Medicine Center for Young Athletes. Welcome, Dr. Chang.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
And joining me here in the studio is Dr. Eric Freitag. He is clinical neuropsychologist, founder and director of the Mount Diablo Memory Center and Sport Concussion Program. Welcome.
Good evening.
And finally, we're joined by Bruce Valentine. He is program manager for athletic training services with UCSF Benioff Children's Hospitals and Sports Medicine Center for Young Athletes. Welcome, Bruce.
Thank you.
And as always, we invite you, our listeners, to join our conversation. We'll open our phone lines in about 20 minutes. The number to dial to join our conversation is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. You can email or text us now at cityvisions@kalw.org. Post a comment at the KALW website or tweet us at City Visions, KALW. So, Eric Freitag, I wanted to start with you. Let's start with some definitions here. Tell us exactly what a concussion is and how do we understand it compared to other forms of injuries to the brain?
Well, a concussion, simply say, is an injury to the brain that's caused by some sort of traumatic blow or event that causes the brain to move rapidly inside of the skull. And that movement in the side of the skull has to have sufficient force or trauma to cause a disruption to your brain. And that disruption is what we commonly perceive as the symptoms, such as a headache or feeling dazed or out of it, feeling disoriented, having memory problems. You can lose consciousness if you have a concussion, but you don't have to lose consciousness in order to have a concussion. In fact, less than 10% of concussions result in a loss of consciousness. But it is a traumatically induced injury that causes an alteration or a change in how your brain functions.
So it's kind of like whiplash for the brain kind of thing? Is that what you're saying?
It's the brain moving rapidly inside of the skull, and that causes a direct injury based on the way our skulls are designed. They're actually pretty rough inside the interior of our skull, and the brain hits up against skull surfaces and can cause an injury to the organ.
And what actually happens to the brain? What do you know about what actually is happening on a physical or molecular level to the brain?
Molecular level is really what's happening. It's a very complex process, but the injury impacts the way our brain utilizes energy. It's a metabolic injury. And simply stated is that when the injury occurs, our brain, the way our brain uses energy becomes impacted. And it gets into a depressed state where you actually have a decrease in cerebral blood flow. And you have an actual injury or disruption to the cellular balance in our brains. And that whole pathophysiological process, to use a big word, is what causes the symptoms to occur.
And so how does a concussion compare to other forms of injury, like a stroke or something else? How do we understand it compared to those?
Well, a complex question that would require a complex answer, with the exception that any sort of brain injury disrupts our brain works either at a molecular level, at a metabolic level, or in some cases like a stroke at a structural level, but it all impacts how our brain functions. And that brain function is how we exist. It's our way we exist in this world, whether it's our memory or how our personalities or our moods. And it can also cause physical symptoms, as we're well aware of, such as the headaches and nausea and balance problems and dizziness.
So Dr. Cindy Chang, how easy is it to diagnose a concussion?
That's a great question. And I think that certainly the more experience that you have as healthcare providers, it's very experiential. The more experience we have with recognizing the signs and symptoms of concussions, then the, quote, easier it is to diagnose it, end of quote. But there's certainly other illnesses or other injuries that can have similar symptoms as concussions. And it's important to be able to delineate and be able to figure out which one are we dealing with when someone presents with symptoms of a concussion. Certainly when you're on the sideline, I'm on the sideline, Bruce Valentine's on the sideline, our athletic trainers, then, and you know the student athletes that are on the field, it is easier to diagnose a concussion when you have seen it happen, for example, or you have student athletes and coaches who are very aware of the signs and symptoms of concussion, teammates who look out for each other, who can help recognize if an athlete is feeling dizzy or not feeling right or can't remember a play. So I think it is easy in terms of we're able to educate, to watch out for the signs and symptoms of concussion. By the time they get to their physician, it may end up being another similar diagnosis, but not necessarily concussion. But certainly with the amount of research that we've done, the signs and symptoms are recognizable and everyone should be educated in terms of what they are.
So you're talking signs and symptoms. How about blood tests or brain scans or something like that? Are there clear ways that concussions are diagnosed indisputably through those types of more definitive tests, or are you really working with signs and symptoms?
Well, I love what you've said. Indisputably and definite signs and definite tests. And I'd have to say the answer to that is no. And no, there is exciting research going on with looking at certain biomarkers in the bloodstream so that you can determine whether or not there possibly could be a concussion. And there are advanced imaging techniques that are being developed to also help with that. But certainly that is all still research-oriented. It's great. We have to keep up with the research so we know what's coming. But right now, there is nothing definitive and indisputable, a blood test or a saliva test that you can do that says, aha, you have a concussion. So what we have is our intuition, some parts of it, honesty of the student athletes, as well as our awareness of the most common signs and symptoms of concussion, and the awareness that even though they've taken a whiplash type of injury, a traumatic blow to the head or to the body that causes their brain to rock back and forth in the skull, they may not necessarily have symptoms right away, and that's why we need to pull them out of a practice or a game and watch them on the sideline or on the bench, because sometimes these symptoms don't appear until after the event, after the practice, or sometimes even hours later.
And Bruce Valentine, I want to pick up on something that Dr. Chang just said there, the honesty of the athlete. So you're there on the sidelines. Why did she say that? Why does this depend on the honesty of the athlete?
Okay, that is another really good question. And, you know, what we see as athletic trainers in the field that work daily in many cases with these athletes, and we've developed a rapport with both athletes, coaches, families, there is a lot of pressure to play out there, both internal pressure of the athlete themselves and the desire to play and the desire to not have a particular event interrupted by injury, and external pressures, you know, could be from teammates, coaches, parents. All of that, you know, social dynamic plays a role in whether a student athlete might want to mask or deny symptoms, which makes it, you know, more of a challenge for the athletic trainer. Hopefully, it is a well-established athletic trainer with a team that is familiar with the athletes and has that rapport where and has educated the team well enough to know that it's not in the student athlete's best interest to mask or deny symptoms.
And how about in the team's interest? I guess how do you?
There is a definite conflict of interest.
Yeah, say
there.
More about that.
And that is also a challenge for the athletic trainer. You know, I was thinking about this morning. You know, an athletic trainer's job isn't dependent on winning and losing. And that can't be said for other people that are involved in the team. You know, they may get dismissed and we may be talking about a key player here. And, you know, and you remove a key player from a game, and that certainly could affect the outcome of a game. That is not a factor for an athletic trainer. The outcome of the game is never a factor. It's the athletic trainer's job to be able to resist those pressures, you know, that.
And when you say athletic trainer, you're just differentiating from coaches and other people here, correct? Okay.
Yeah, and you know, I feel fairly confident in speaking for any medical professional that, you know, the health and safety of the athlete is a primary concern and not the outcome of an event or a game.
But and that's where education comes in.
Eric Freitag.
Because what Bruce said is so important, and also for the athletes and coaches to understand that a concussed athlete is not a good teammate.
No.
They will perform more poorly on the field, and there has been some research that has supported that when players come back from a concussion or return too soon after a concussion, their reaction times are slower, they may not be able to process information as efficiently or effectively, and they don't play as well.
So it's not only bad for the athlete, it's bad for the team ultimately. So staying with you, Eric, why is the recognition of concussion so important? What can happen? You mentioned some short-term things there, right, about how it may affect their performance in the game. But what are some of the other things where you're worried about that might happen if we don't recognize the concussion and treat it, as we'll hear about more in a moment?
Well, recognition is really that first key step for anyone involved in whether it be coaches, parents, administrators, is to be aware of the signs and symptoms so they can identify and recognize when a concussion occurs. The reason why that's important is because management of the injury occurs right at the point of the injury. And right at that moment of the injury, we are setting the stage for either a good outcome where the athlete is managed properly and they get good health care and they can return back to their sport without really any sort of long-term implications or consequences. And if that proper management occurs from the get-go, then these athletes will recover, they will heal, they will be fine. And that's why I love doing the work that I do, because once we start managing them properly, that most of the time they will return to their sport. If they're mismanaged by allowed to return too soon, first and foremost, if your brain is injured and you return to play too soon, you're at exceptionally high risk for re-injury. And
how so?
Well, the brain's not much different from any other part of our body. So think if you have an injured knee and you go out to play too soon and you take a wrong cut or a wrong turn, you could re-injure that knee worse. When part of that cellular injury that I talked about earlier, that molecular injury, it leaves the brain in an especially sensitive state toward re-injury. Because the brain is trying to reestablish the and heal itself. And during that process, it's very sensitive to re-injury. So if it gets re-injured while it is still injured, you'll very often have an increase in severity and take longer to recover from your symptoms. It can make you especially sensitive towards having prolonged post-concussive symptoms, where you take an injury that maybe would have gotten back to normal in 2 to 4 weeks, now takes 6, 8, 12 weeks or longer to recover. And in very rare circumstances, it can trigger an event called second impact syndrome. And that we still don't quite understand why it occurs in certain athletes, but maybe, you know, a handful of athletes, 1 to 2 athletes per year, actually die from the condition. And what it is when an injured brain, predominantly in youth athletes, returns to play too soon and gets another injury, so a kind of a cumulative or secondary injury, and the brain goes into this pathophysiological state where it has massive swelling and can cause significant and severe permanent brain damage or even oftentimes death. Fortunately, again, it's a very rare event, but nonetheless, we have to be aware of it clinically, and that does factor into our management of the injury.
Dr. Chang, I want to go back to you about, let's talk about the different sports, the different contact sports. Is there sort of a hierarchy of risk here depending on the sport that's being played? And then can you tell us a little bit about who's most at risk even within those sports?
Well, certainly, injury data has been collected for years, usually at the professional level and the collegiate level, because it's certainly easier to collect that type of data. And even in the military, there has been much less data collected in our youth and adolescent athletes and even our high school athletes because they are minors and because of the difficulty in collecting data, because most schools, especially in the state of California, do not have athletic trainers, much less full-time athletic trainers. So there is a pretty robust database, though, that we've been using, and it's through the National Federation of State High School Associations and Dawn Constock's data that she uses through Rio. And she's collected data that has been able to show us the risk of concussions in certain groups. And certainly American football is very high on the list of concussions. And practice versus gameplay also shows us that injuries are happening. And the one thing that we have to keep in consideration is most of the time we have medical care, including athletic trainers and team physicians, only at games. But, concussions are also happening during practices as well. And so one of the things that we have to keep in mind is if we want to protect our children, especially who are playing high school sports, then consideration needs to be having a healthcare professional at the school site during the after-school hours when practices are happening, and not just in football but the other sports, because they can happen in wrestling, they can happen in basketball, soccer, and those are the higher sports. There's not a lot of ice hockey at our high schools here in California, but that is certainly another sport that has a high incidence of concussions. And then we get to cheer, and cheer had a high incidence of concussions, and we were able to reduce that rate once a law was passed in terms of changing how high up the formations could go, and as well as in terms of how high, no throws off at the top, no one could jump off something that was more than two people tall. And so some of those rule changes have ended up in being that those concussions have lessened, especially in the cheer group. And then I think you said position. It's certainly, there's no question that depending on the position you play, you have a less risk of concussions than other positions, and that goes across many, many sports.
And so it seems like we've been identifying more and more concussions, perhaps because there's more education and more awareness and more honesty, because people feel more comfortable being upfront about these things. Are we actually seeing just more reporting of concussions, or are we actually seeing an increase in the number? Can you tell the difference?
I think it's challenging to tell the difference. And I do feel that when we see blips in terms of the incidence of concussions, it certainly could be because people are more aware. People are coming out on their own. Kids are coming out on their own and saying, I think I have symptoms of a concussion. And it's becoming more accepted to be able to respect your brain first and respect the fact that you've had an injury and be able to tell the coaching staff and medical staff, if they're around, that they feel like they have symptoms of a concussion. And what's happened in the state of California, of which I'm very proud, is that we have passed several either state laws or the CIF, or the California Interscholastic Federation, which is the governing body for state high school athletics. They've passed bylaws that really have gone further to protect the student-athlete than many other states. So, the first bylaw was passed that essentially stated that it was modeled after the Zachary Leifert law in the state of Washington, that if you have a concussion or signs of symptoms of concussion and you recognize it in a student athlete, you need to be pulled out of the game. Hmm. When in doubt, sit him out. And then the following year, and then return to play, et cetera. Those were implemented. And then the following year, there was that coaches need to be educated. Coaches need to take an educational course. It can either be online or in person. Every 2 years, educating them about the signs and symptoms of concussions and the diagnosis and management. And then most recently, a law was passed last year, which was a return to play legislation, which essentially states that a student athlete in the state of California can return to play no sooner than 7 days after the diagnosis of a concussion. And that is clearly, the legislation was written, it was applied to football, but the CIF decided to apply that to all high school sports. And so that rule is in place now, and you can find all of that information as well as some helpful educational forums on CIFstate.org.
CIFstate.org. We'll put that on our website. Before we go to station ID, Bruce Valentine, I wanted to ask you, so it seems like you have legislation on your side, right? That in order to help advocate for the health of the athletes that you are concerned with. How are you still facing barriers? Are you still, you know, you mentioned various stakeholders there that you're,
yes.
you know, the parents, the coaches, the athletes themselves, the school administration, who else? I don't know.
Fellow teammates.
How easy has this legislation made it for you to navigate and be able to advocate for the athlete that you're most concerned about in the moment?
Well, if you can see my face, I have a big smile on it right now. And it's really done amazing things to help the athletic trainer in the field. One, if for no other reason, it's just raised awareness of the issues that athletic trainers have long been aware of. You know, unfortunately, we've learned more and more over the years, and a lot from the military, that things are just not as good as we thought they were. And the more we find out, the more fearful we get of the problem. Anyway, these laws, you know, which kind of take out of our hands the decisions whether to allow somebody to play or not, given all these outside pressures, it's very simple now. I mean, if you come off looking dizzy, complaining of a headache somewhere, you know, specific, you're not going to return to this game. And you're going to end up seeing a medical practitioner, licensed medical practitioner, with some experience in management of concussion, like Dr. Cindy Chang or Dr. Eric Freitag. And then either you're going to get the diagnosis from the licensed medical practitioner, or they're going to clear the person as not having had a concussion. But it just relieves the athletic trainer, who's there on a daily basis, of a lot of this responsibility, which ultimately would have only fallen on the athletic trainer. So I'm very grateful as an athletic trainer to be able to have all these other resources available to me, like we have at UCSF Benioff Children's Hospital Oakland, that it's not all on me anymore. We like a team approach to these problems. There are plenty of athletic trainers out there and plenty of EMTs or doctors working sidelines where they're out there by themselves, and they don't have that team unless they build it, and that's always a challenge. So the laws have greatly helped relieve the athletic trainer of all the responsibility.
So do you have any barriers at this point, or do you feel like finally people,
well, let's say
you don't have to be doing the heavy lifting here. Okay.
There's fewer barriers.
What's left?
Well, I mean, you're still going to get into these conversations. I won't call them arguments, but conversations with coaches and parents and athletes themselves, because they're stuck in the moment. And it's my job, you know, as an athletic trainer to look at the bigger picture. And I have to help them learn what the bigger picture is, because it might not be this game.
Right. This is City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and tonight we're discussing concussions in student athletes, both treatment, prevention, and how the game or the response to the effects of the game is changing as we speak. So we invite you, our listeners, to call in with your questions and comments on this topic. Have you or a family member ever suffered a concussion? Tell us about your experience. Or are you a coach or a trainer with experience dealing with players who have sustained concussions? How do you feel that the rules that have been enacted in the last several years have changed the game for better? Or perhaps not. Call us at 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. You can also email or text us at cityvisions@kalw.org, post comment at the KALW website, or tweet us at cityvisionskalw. So, Eric Freitag, I wanted to go back to a little bit more about demographics here. So tell us, are there particular ages type of athlete or male versus female that sort of makes a difference in terms of risk for a concussion or recovery from a concussion?
Well, we do know when we're talking gender differences that female athletes tend to be more susceptible to concussion injuries. And research that has looked at equivalent sports, so for example, female soccer players versus male soccer players, basketball, et cetera, tend to experience concussions at higher rates than the male counterparts.
And do you know why that is?
Well, we think we do. There's basically three prevailing theories, all with pretty strong evidence, so it's probably a combination of all three. One is a culture of reporting. Female athletes may be more willing to report, not as much of a machismo culture as compared to a male counterpart. Second is there might be hormonal differences that may cause more susceptibility towards brain injury. And then the third theory is less or not as strong in the core. So a neck musculature, core musculature is not as strong as male athletes. And so when you have a weaker core and you don't have as strong of a neck, it causes, when you do receive a blow, more of that energy is then transferred to the head. The head can move more in a whipping action, and that may cause more susceptibility to injury. Now, as far as developmental differences for both male and females, when you're looking at younger athletes versus older athletes, we do know that a younger brain is more susceptible to injury. And there's lots of neurological developmental reasons for that. I certainly see it clinically that it does take longer, and research has supported this, that younger athletes tend to take longer and require a much more conservative management than for older athletes. So when you're even looking at high school, a freshman and a sophomore, oftentimes the management and the symptom expression of that younger athlete is different from a junior or senior level athlete.
So, Dr. Chang, I know you can only stay with us for the first 30 minutes of our program. So just before I let you go, I just wanted to ask, you know, you've been working in this field for quite a while and have highlighted quite a bit of advances in the way this issue is addressed. What do you see as next steps in this area that we should be focusing on?
Well, I'd like to, first of all, thank both Bruce and Eric for being on the program. These guys are really they're part of the team. And one of the things in terms of advancing our ability to diagnose and manage concussions better for our student-athlete population starts with the athletic trainer on the sideline or at the games. And the one thing is that you're able to educate your student-athletes, your parent population, your coaching population, your administration at the high school, at the club level, if you're there on a pretty regular basis and you earn the trust of everyone involved in youth sports. And the fact is that we can't do that if our athletic trainers aren't there. They're not hired enough hours, or the school simply doesn't have an athletic trainer. And my recommendation, of which I, this is my opinion, is that if you're going to have a strong, robust athletic program, which I think is important for student athlete development emotionally and physically, I feel that you should have someone there who's going to be there looking after the health and welfare of your student athletes. And we will be able to diagnose and pull more kids out and be able to assess them. And they may go back in, because if they don't, you know, if they don't have signs of symptoms of concussion, or it wasn't really what that was, but we need someone there on the sideline with them to help them. And if there's any suggestion, they're out. Because we know that, and research has shown this, and fortunately, you know, we're doing a lot of research on animal studies, because that's what we can do it on. We can look at the brains of rats. That's the animal that's more that's studied the most. And we know that if we can protect the brain and have the brain recover fully, if that brain gets a second concussion, brain injury, it will recover just like the first one did. But it's those concussions that go back too soon, that are not recognized, that the student-athlete hides those concussion symptoms, and they go back to activity, and they get another trauma to the brain, that then those symptoms last longer, and they persist longer. I think the most exciting thing for me as a physician is knowing that there is great research out there to look at all these things. I will say, you know, when I started seeing patients in 1992, we looked at physical symptoms, headache, nausea, dizziness. We looked at cognitive type of symptoms. They lose memory. You know, they can't recall things. We look at sleep problems. They couldn't fall asleep, or they slept too much, or they woke up in the middle of the night, and they became more emotional. But now we're seeing there's so much more. The brain controls everything. And we've been seeing patients now with balance problems, with visual problems, with even neuroendocrine problems. So having had a mild traumatic brain injury can impact the brain much more than what was initially discussed 15 years ago, 15, 20 years ago. We know now that more and more things can happen, so we have to be very diligent with our questioning, our medical evaluation, and that's why I think it's so important that when a child has been diagnosed or has a suspected concussion, that they go see their pediatrician or their family physician, or they go see a concussion specialist who can delve deeper into the possible, you know, the possible signs and symptoms and how this can impact their learning, their return to school. Because it's not just about returning back to play the game. It's about returning back to school and being an active participant in the educational environment who can learn. That's key, and that should be number one priority for us.
Well, thank you so much. That was Dr. Cindy Chang, sports medicine specialist with the UCSF Benioff Children's Hospitals and Sports Medicine Center for Young Athletes. Thanks for joining us tonight.
Thank you, Joseph. Thanks for inviting me.
And this is City Visions on 91.7 local public radio, KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and we are joined, in addition to Dr. Chang there, by two other guests, Bruce Valentine, Program Manager for Athletic Training Services with UCSF Benioff Children's Hospitals and Sports Medicine Center for Young Athletes, and by Dr. Eric Freitag. He is clinical neuropsychologist, founder and director of the Mount Diablo Memory Center and Sport Concussion Program. Again, we open our phone lines to you, our listeners, to call in with questions and comments. The number to dial to join our conversation is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. Let's go to our first caller. That's Candace from Oakland. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you.
Yes, hi.
Hi. So I just had a quick comment, and I'm really, really happy to hear this program right now. My family is what can be called a football family, and we grew up on football. The boys played football, and all the girls cheerleaded for their team. I'm 24, and my older brother is 26, and I've been going to his games since he was in Mighty Mites. I think he started around the age of six. And he would get, you know, knocked around, these little, what I know now as microconcussions. And so he'd get knocked around, and as he got older, the knockarounds got harder. And then we got all the way to high school, and I remember vividly the multiple concussions that he would have. And he'd get on the sidelines, but the trainer would come, and they'd check him out, and then he'd get back in the game. So they'd shake him and be like, well, you're okay. You'll be fine. Can you see? Can you talk? All right, can you finish the game? And then he'd get back in the game. And I also remember him having these major mood swings, and he'd be depressed often, and sometimes he'd have trouble in school, and just because he can't comprehend. And in the light of all of the research of CTE and all this stuff, it's really affected our family, and we've reflected on this, and it's almost kind of like closure in a way, that all of these little concussions and all of the big concussions that he's had have taken a really interesting toll on his brain. And we've been getting little scans, and we've had talks about it. And I just wanted to leave this comment that I'm so happy that all of this research is happening right now, and that we know a lot of things right now about this, and it's just going to get more and more in depth.
Well, thank you so much, Candace, for your call.
Thank you.
415-841-4134 is the number to dial to join our conversation. Let's go next to Anne. Anne is calling from San Francisco. Welcome to the program.
Yes, thank you. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, I'll try to keep it succinct. Years ago, I suffered a concussion. There's really no one to talk to about it. I guess looking at the bright side, getting an MRI, my skull wasn't fractured, but I was mugged by strangers, two guys that I know of. I heard male voices behind me, and I got mugged, and it can always be worse. However, and I grew up in a family of many brothers, and it took years for me to understand the anger, the sarcasm, the silences, and a lot is related to what boys are told in relation to don't feel. You know, be tough, be a man, be... But anyway, that's a whole other show. I wanted to say that, you know, this culture, it's worshipful of sports, and it's all hooked in corporately, and that's got to be obvious to a lot of people. And once in a while, it's talked about that as how it can relate to what women suffer, relating to family of origin violence, domestic violence, whatever. And no, I don't feel like talking about this anymore. Many people suffer concussions way beyond the sports world, and connect it with maybe a lot of the concussions suffered by guys in the sports world. I don't know. I really, but I'll go ahead and go now. Thank you.
Thanks, Anne, for your call. So we have an email from earlier that I wanted to get to, if I can find it. Here we go. It's an email from Carl, and he said, I heard the argument that there would be far less brain damage in boxing if it was practiced bare-knuckled, as fear of breaking one's hands would prevent the kind of blows that lead to brain damage. Could a similar argument be made for football regarding helmets and pads? Is there less evidence of, and then follow-up question, is there less evidence of brain damage in rugby, meaning there's not as much protective equipment? So I guess the root of Carl's question there is, how much is the protective equipment giving people a false sense of protection? And if we remove the protective equipment, could that actually make the game safer? I'm going to ask both of you to comment on that. First, Eric Freitag, and then Bruce Valentine.
Well, it's an interesting theory. I don't know if it's one that would ever play out in reality. The rugby question gets brought up a lot, and it's one example of how people try to advocate for, you see, it's because they wear these helmets, and it is true that football players, the more safe they feel, it's called a risk compensation model. And that's not only true for football helmets, but it's true for skiers that wear helmets, soccer players when they wear headgear. I mean, they've done research that have shown there is some risk compensation. But if we're speaking of football specifically, they feel like their helmet is safer, then they may be more apt to use that helmet as a first point of contact. And I've talked to football players. I'm friends with some retired ex-pro players, and they said they were instructed that when you go in for a tackle, you use your head as a missile. Fortunately, I think that's changing now, but you know, this was recently, it's just a few years ago. But rugby, they do suffer concussions, not maybe at the same rate because they're, at the same numbers, because there's just not as many players in America that play rugby as football. But the rates, you know, as far as percentage of athletes that do experience, is not that much difference. I mean, it is a sport that is high risk for concussions.
Mm-hmm. Bruce, what's your take on that?
I agree that the equipment can be used as a weapon. I mean, there's no doubt that that's happened in the past, but I would say that's been the past. I mean, they used to teach, you know, to use the helmet when tackling, and they don't do that anymore. At least I don't see it. And if I did see it, I would be correcting them because of the risk, and not only to concussion, but also for spinal cord injury. And it's not very hard to scare a kid out of doing those sorts of things if they understood what the risk was. There is a myth that out there that might lead one to believe that if I wore this specific helmet, I would be safer than, you know, this other type of helmet. There's no evidence to bear that out, that one type of equipment is better than another. The helmet is important to protect against other types of injuries too, like facial injuries and skull fractures, and it does a very good job of that. Now, the football helmet has to be well fitted and tested on an annual basis, which all the high schools and colleges and pro teams have their helmets retested on an annual basis. But they have to fit well. And you know, that's where having an athletic trainer on the sidelines helps, because sometimes it's, you know, you go to the locker room and they hand you the helmet off the shelf and they didn't even watch you put it on. Huh. And then I would go out there and grab on a face mask and practically turn it around on the kid's head and say, "You can't use that." You know,
right.
So if the equipment is ill-fitting, your risk is worse. If it's well-fitting, I would say there's no difference or little difference between rugby and football as to the rates of concussion.
So I want to talk about some other prevention measures that might relate to helmets, like sensors and helmets, in a moment. But I have to ask sort of a fundamental question that came up when Dr. Chang mentioned that, you know, the rates of injury in those doing cheer has gone down because the rules of cheer have changed. Is there a possibility that the rules of the game will change? Will the game ever change enough to be able to reduce the risk? Or is it just kind of part and parcel of what a game, how a game is played, and it's just not going to change culturally?
Well, first of all, regarding the cheerleading, it's probable that the risk has gone down, but I probably see just as many cheerleaders as I do other athletes. And cheerleaders are athletes. And it's flyers, the ones that fly in the air, and it's the base, the ones who catch them. I see a fair amount of concussions with cheerleaders. But as far as reducing risk, Bruce mentioned properly fitting equipment that's in good condition, and rule modifications can do lower the risk in some instances. For example, the changes to kickoffs that they did in college and pro football, potentially that has lowered the reduced the risk of some concussions, because kickoffs are some of the higher risk plays in football that cause concussions, because it got players, big heavy players, running super fast right at each other. If you look at other sports, for example, soccer, I'm a soccer referee, and a point of emphasis over the last few years has really been trying to cut down on impacts to the head, elbows, and other body parts and collisions to the head. And so you try as an official in any sport to enforce the rules as best you can. But at the end of the day, in the cases of football or hockey or rugby, you are playing a collision sport where players run into each other that are very fast and very big, and you're going to have concussions. When you have other contact sports like soccer and basketball, you're going to have concussions. We can never quite eliminate the risk. We never come close to eliminating the risk. There are certain things that can be done to potentially reduce the risk, though. Mm.
So, Bruce, do you see other areas, that rule changes that could have high impact, so to speak, in reducing the risk of concussion that have not yet been enacted?
I tend to agree with Eric, and I don't think you can eliminate the risk. And if, I mean, I've thought about this long and hard for many years, and, you know, the way we teach an athlete to play a sport, that can have an impact on whether or not their risk is high or low. You know, there's a thing called head-up tackling, you know, and they used to teach a kid to actually put a helmet on the ball because it's quite effective in knocking a ball out of somebody's hand. But, you know, the consequences, and we would laud the play, too, after it happened. If it resulted in a fumble, I say we in a greater sense, not necessarily me, myself. And it's just a high-risk way to play the game. And if today, when we're teaching, you know, especially that one caller mentioned, you know, Pop Warner football, they're starting at a very young age, and that's the age at which to teach them, you know, proper tackling technique. And tackling is one of those activities in football where a lot of the concussion occurs. And as Eric said, it is classified as a collision sport. And, you know, you would think getting in a car accident in a collision in a car is a risky behavior. These kids are doing it intentionally. Mm-hmm. And that's part of the game. That part of the game you will never be able to rule out with rules. I mean, that is the game, and it's the game that we Americans love, you know.
So this is City Visions on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KLW San Francisco, and on the web at KLW.org. And we're talking about sports-related concussions in student athletes with our guests, Dr. Eric Freitag and Bruce Valentine. 415-841-4134 is the number to dial to join our conversation. You can also email us at cityvisions@klw.org, post a comment at the KLW website, or tweet us at cityvisionsklw. So, Bruce, to your point there, we have a call from Rachel in San Francisco, who I think wants to respond to that cultural pressure of these sports. Go ahead, Rachel.
Hi there. I would love to ask you personally, the medical providers, the athletic providers, given all that we know about this, and as the last athletic director said, this sport's not going away. We love this. We're bloodthirsty. We're, you know, it's deep in our genetic pool, in our gene pool, to have this gladiator sports. Are you allowing your daughter to play games like this? Are you allowing your sons? I'm seeing that, you know, I'm a medical provider as well, but I want to know, when are you guys going to step up to the plate and if people want to do this, fine. But you need to sign these papers saying you are signing away, you know, you're very aware of the risks, and, you know, make it a legal situation. It's like, we are not responsible when your kid, and a lot of these injuries happen during practice, not during games, you know, these headbutts and whatnot. You are allowing your child to play this lethal sport with the huge risk of injury that can surface 10, 20 years later in, you know, really messed up lives. I mean, I'm not trying to be alarmist. I'm not expecting a risk-free life, but my God, you know, when are the medical providers and the athletic providers going to step up and say, hey? And as far as helmets go, you know, how about the parents want to, you know, pitch in for the $3,000 helmet? You pay half, the school pays half, if you know, or something along those lines.
Thank you so much, Rachel, for your call. So I want to get some responses from both of you. We also have a few other callers to get to, but let's respond to Rachel's comments. Let's start with you, Eric.
Sure. The reason why I do this work is because I love sports. And the good thing about this work is that if the injury does occur, we can manage these injuries. If they're managed properly, we can send those kids back out to play as safely as possible, creating a competitive environment that is as safe as possible. I think the benefits of sports far outweigh the potential risk. And when we look at as a whole, as far as what sports can provide to these young athletes as they grow older to become adults is we have less risk of cardiovascular disease, less risk of other disorders associated with living a sedentary lifestyle, overweight, diabetes, et cetera, that if we can establish early on a love of sport, a love of competition, a love of being athletic and physical, that that will stay with the person hopefully through the rest of their life where they live a physically fit lifestyle. I played sports all the way through high school, collegiately, professionally, and now as I'm approaching 40, I still play in a men's basketball league, an old man's league, and I'm sore every Monday after I play. But I love sports and it helps keep me physically fit, and I know that the reason why I do that is because I had that as a foundation growing up. So the benefits clearly outweigh the risk.
So, Bruce, do you agree that there's a level of acceptable risk here and that somehow athletic trainers and medical professionals are not sort of abdicating their responsibility for these athletes by allowing them to play these sports, as Rachel is questioning here?
Well, I mean, she makes a great point, and I think the answer is sociological, you know, in nature. And as Eric alluded, you know, there are far more benefits to kids participating in sports and athletics than these risks that we know exist. We're able to identify, you know, the consequences, and we're able to shepherd somebody to the right way to go about taking care of an injury or a problem versus leaving them to their own devices, that I think just the benefits far outweigh the consequences or the negative impacts. As far as my own child was an athlete, played soccer, baseball, worked on the sidelines at Pop Warner football games with me as a kid, you know, carrying water to kids playing football. And he made his own decision, likely from what he saw when he was young, that he didn't want to play football. And I didn't pressure him to do that. And I perfectly accepted what his decision was. If he had decided to play football, I wouldn't have denied him that opportunity, but I probably would have wanted to be there.
All right, let's go to Philip from Richmond. Philip?
Hello.
Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, I can appreciate the comments that the two gentlemen are making here, but you know, you've only got half the conversation going. You only have half the number of people in this panel. You don't have any college presidents. You don't have any athletic directors. You don't have any coaches. When you think about the impact, there, I read the statistic the other day that either 37 or 47 states in this country, the highest paid public official is a college football coach. Now, with that kind of money motivation and the kind of sponsorship that Nike and the rest of them put out there, you're only good enough if you're number one. And you're only good enough, number one, is if you beat up on the other team. You guys may have good intentions, but the money is the motivating factor here that's keeping and holding you guys back. It's only going to be it was only when lawsuits started coming to the pro levels and all these guys had these concussions and they're getting beat up silly, and they started these multi-gazillion-dollar lawsuits against them. That's what's going to change this. That's what's going to force you guys, the athletic directors, the facilities people, to kind of step up to the plate. Now, Rachel's saying you don't have to take responsibility and sign some kind of waiver. No, not with the kids. You know, I've been playing sports all my life, and I love it, and I love the competition, but not if that is going to be at the cost of these kids in the long term. So I can appreciate what you're saying. I think the equipment is not designed to protect the person. It's designed to protect the kid so he can hit harder. He can hit harder. That's why you have that equipment. It's not to, not for their own safety, only to make the sport a little more gladiator-like, as the woman said. So I think the rule changes are very helpful. There'll be a lot more changes coming as more lawsuits come to these schools to see that you guys are not doing the job of protecting our kids.
Thank you so much for your call. I'm going to get one more caller in, and then we can get some comments from our guests here. Claudia from San Mateo, welcome to the program.
Hi there. Yeah, I wanted to comment on the guest's comments about the difference between rugby and football, specifically that there is no big difference, and I have to beg to differ. I was an athletic trainer in college. I did rugby and lacrosse and football, and we did lots of studies, and I studied the studies. There may not be that many rugby players in the United States to keep track of, but in England and, you know, all the Commonwealth countries, there's a ton. And let me tell you, there's way, way fewer, not just concussions, but other injuries. And that is because part of what the previous caller just said was the equipment is designed in football to hurt the other person, not necessarily to protect the kids playing and the men playing football. Also, rugby players from a very young age learn how to tackle properly because they don't have equipment, so they know how to tackle without hurting themselves and bringing down somebody else without hurting themselves too badly. In football, it's all about trying to get at those parts with your head, yes, and they still use their helmets, and they try to aim it at parts of the body that aren't covered with, you know, their armor, like the side of the knee or the kidneys. And there's a lot of really, I just have to say, a lot of really scary things about American football, and it is a gladiator-type sport. It is all about hurting people, and if you see people that love it and watch it...
Yeah, Claudia, I'm sorry. I'm going to have to cut you off there, but thanks for your call. So we have just a couple of minutes left in our program. So I want to offer the two guests, Eric and Bruce, to respond to some of the callers' comments, but also tell us about... what you think are some of the next steps here that we're looking for. We didn't really get a chance to talk about the helmet technology. It seems like perhaps that's not what a lot of people think is going to change the game, so to speak, in terms of concussions. But if you can just tell us what you think are some next steps here, and if you'd like, sort of wrap in some responses to our callers. Let's start with you, Bruce, and then we'll end with you, Eric.
Me, as Bruce Valentine, athletic trainer who's worked with high school kids for over 20 years, you know, I am not advocating one sport over another. I just happen to be an athletic trainer, and I put myself where the risk is greatest. And here in the Bay Area and in the U.S. and the state of California, that happens to be with kids playing American football. So I'm not an advocate for football or against it. I just know that it's being played, and therefore I put myself where my skill could be used the most, and that is to protect the health and welfare of the athlete. And that's about all I have to add on that.
Okay, and Eric, you get the last word here.
You know, if we can focus on those that are involved in youth sports becoming educated on how to identify and appropriately respond to concussion injuries, then I would gladly be out of a job, or at least part of a job. Because the fact of the matter is that most of the patients that I see in my clinic, the reason why they're in my clinic is because they were very poorly managed. They were allowed to return to play too soon. They weren't properly managed with their symptoms. They returned to school and so forth. And so really education is the key. And that really needs to be a foundation before people start talking about adding in baseline testing or computerized or sensors, things like that. You need to be educated on these issues.
Okay, so we're going to have to stop it there. As always, we could go on, and perhaps we'll bring you back to talk about this some more. As you see, it got a lot of our listener attention, and I want to thank those who we weren't able to get to tonight. That's City Visions. My guests were Dr. Cindy Chang and Bruce Valentine of UCSF Benioff Children's Hospitals, and Dr. Eric Freitag, founder and director of Mount Diablo Memory Center and Sport Concussion Program. For a link to this and other City Visions shows, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Visions page at KALW.org. Our engineer this evening was David LaTulipe. Tonight's show was produced by Ann Harper. Join us next Monday when we take a look at changing rules in parental leave. This is Joseph Pache for all of us here. Thanks for listening. Good night. Have a great week.